Welcome to Frame of Reference, informed, intelligent conversations about the issues and challenges facing everyone in today's world. In-depth interviews with Sauk County's leaders and professionals to help you expand and inform your frame of reference. Brought to you by the Max FM Digital Network. Now here's your host, Raoul Labrèche.
And welcome to another edition of Frame of Reference, Sauk County's only, that's right, I'm sticking with only podcast devoted singularly to interviewing the movers and the shakers of Sauk County and beyond. It's always a great time for me when I can have a guest on that was a part of my previous broadcasting when we were doing Mornings at McFarland's. This is a guy that I actually met, I think, while we were doing that show. And we got to talking about things. And, you know, you have those people in your life that just right away you click with and you really like talking to them. So when I started this new endeavor, he was one of the first people I reached out and said, "Buddy, would you come be a buddy and talk on my show?" So, and of course, I'm talking about Buddy Huffaker, the executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation and Center up in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Buddy, thanks so much for joining.
Oh, great to be with you always, Raoul. Yeah.
You know, and it's fun to have someone there that's got a Cromer on with me and we can talk, you know, and be the guys from the upwoods there now once he, right? So, Buddy, I got to say, you know, it's nice to have somebody on that has just an effervescent feeling. I mean, you guys have been through the ringer, and as a lot of organizations have with all that happened with COVID, and yet you have maintained your effervescent, you know, upbeat attitude. How do you do it? What's going on?
Well, I don't know what you laugh or you cry. So we've done some of both of those in the last year. But sure. Yeah, you know, like every individual, family, and organization, we've had our challenges over the last year, but a lot of credit to our team, very resilient, and I think, you know, a lot of commitment to try to make do good in the world.
Yeah.
And so we've pivoted our operations. Our field team has been able to stay kind of in full motion. That was able, you know, outdoors, that work was able to continue under COVID.
Okay.
And then our education team just kind of realized that, you know, that the world has shifted and changed. And so if we couldn't bring people to us at the Leopold Center, that we'd go see them. And so we use virtual technology to do that. Last fall, we took our crane program on the road. Okay. And shared with our audience the wildlife spectacle that occurs every year.
Okay.
On the Wisconsin River, of tens of thousands of sandhill cranes coming to roost every evening. And then this past spring, we did Leopold Week virtually and did programming that then we could share outwardly to audiences all across the country and really across the world.
So that was like the first week of March that you were doing that.
Yeah. Okay. So Leopold Week, I mean, for those that, you know, just quick intro to Leopold, if you're not familiar, he's the author of a Sand County Almanac. He was a professor of wildlife ecology at the University of Wisconsin, but his real passion was his farm up here in Sauk County outside of Baraboo. So the Leopold Foundation now owns and manages that historic site. We manage it for wildlife purposes. We do environmental education there. And we're the executor of his literary estate. So we help bring his work out into new languages and in new formats.
Okay.
So, you know, that's Leopold. And then he's now become kind of a world icon in the movement, environmental conservation movement. And so, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, actually, the state of Wisconsin, kind of to recognize his impact in the state and beyond, created Leopold Week, which is the first week in March every year. Okay. And it's kind of a time to celebrate, and we would like to say, reflect and look forward about where we're at in our relationship to the natural world and what we still need to do moving forward.
Okay. So, and that's a great segue, reflecting and moving forward, because I always like to start out the show with a little get to know people that are on the show and a little bit of an icebreaker. Although with you, I don't know that you need an icebreaker. It's maybe like a lukewarm stirring rod or something. But it's just called My Favorite Things. And we just kind of go through some things. This is very Rorschachian. You know, just there's no right or wrong answers, no F-bombs, please. We try to keep this family friendly. But, you know.
You really limited my repertoire.
I know. Right away, you're like, oh, geez, everything was going to be F that and F this, you know. So, but no, I know Buddy too well. That's just a joke between he and I, okay? Okay, so here we go. No holds barred. Ready? And first question is, favorite bird?
Ooh. Sandhill crane.
See, I kind of was thinking that's what it was going to be, but I thought, well, you know, let's see. Maybe it's a little diverse, right? How about favorite color?
Black.
Oh, black. Really? Why black?
Man in Black.
Oh, okay. Like you, the aliens guy, so this one, or just
Johnny
the man
Cash.
In Johnny Cash?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Sorry. That's Men in Black. I'm thinking of your Man in Black. Okay. I Walk the Line, all that good stuff. Yeah. Okay. So how about favorite book?
Well, kind of have to say a Sand County Almanac, but if it's not for personally, maybe Where the Red Fern Grows.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a sad book, isn't it?
It is kind of sad, but it's, you know, it's about this young boy's bond with his dogs. Yeah. They spend a lot of time out in nature.
Sure. That's that one of those, though, that's in the movie list of Where the Dog Dies. And you, I think that one, it's actually on that list.
So it's hard to watch or read and not shed tears. Yes.
Yeah. That one and Old Yeller and all. So, which, you know, then again, you get another dog. We've gone through that multiple times in my household. Right. So, how about a favorite animal? Do you have a favorite animal?
Well, just this week, I got to see river otter, which is pretty rare and hard to see. Okay. So they're on top of my list right now.
Okay.
I'm just thankful that they presented themselves for
me. They just said, hey, we're here. Anyone wants to gather around, come talk with us?
Yeah. They called me out.
Are they social animals?
No, they're really hard. They're pretty elusive. There aren't very many sightings of them. So. Okay. It was a pair, could probably starting breeding time, so they might have been a little bit more open or active with each other. So
maybe there was a new couples gathering somewhere that they were getting ready to go to or something. You never know. River otters are strange and elusive, you said.
Strange and elusive. Secretive and elusive, yes.
We just don't know what those river otters are up to. So how about a favorite quote?
I'll give you two. Let's see. One's Aldo Leopold quote. We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see it as a community to which we belong, we will begin to use it with love and respect. So again, this kind of sense of community, our connection to each other in the natural world. And then one I just always seem to use is from Arnold Palmer. And he had a line that went, golf is a game of luck, but I found the more I practice, the luckier I get. So that seems to – I find that very resonant for me in my life. I think a lot of things have happened by happenstance and luck, but I also hope I've played a role in making sure that good luck continues.
Right. I think of like my theater background, and you know, you can talk about being lucky in that role too, you know, being in the right place at the right time. But you know, obviously preparing yourself and being as involved in as many things as possible, you increase your chances of being observed and whatever. So how about, do you have a favorite thing to do like when you're like stressing or maybe just need to just kind of get off by yourself and do something? Is there a favorite activity or?
Well, I do. I hike a lot. I spend a lot of time outdoors. I will have to say I like a pretty good nap too.
Really?
So
okay.
when I get some free time.
Yeah.
Cuddling up on the couch on a nice sunny day. That's pretty
hard to beat that.
It is.
I tell you, we got a couple of dogs not too long ago. A mom and her little, at that point, three-week-old pup. And the two of them have been just such a joy, but sleeping with them. In fact, before I came down here to do this interview today, I had fallen asleep in my Lazy Boy chair with one on my chest and the other one on my lap, and it just doesn't get any better than that.
No,
you know? So, but okay, this is my segue then always into the next portion of the show, but do you have a favorite memory when you were growing up, something that really you think back to now every now and then, and whenever you do, it either brings a smile to your face or it makes you just kind of go to that happy place, you know, we talk about it. But, you know, I think there are just those kind of pleasant things that we recognize are formative in a lot of ways. Do you remember anything like that?
Probably thinking back, fishing with my grandfather.
Okay.
And just how much pleasure he got out of that. He was kind of a man of not a lot of words.
Okay.
So it was a time to be with him and be outdoors and do something fun, and to see him get excited when I would catch a fish. I think I don't know that was pivotal in my kind of thought to pursue conservation, but I think it's certainly,
it helped.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
It was back in there.
Well, yeah, being out and having those strong positive feelings associated with being in the outdoors, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of communication research and studies too that talk about it. It's not so much the words. In fact, words carry something like 7 or 8% of the meaning in what we're talking to people, but the nonverbals are extremely important. They end up being, you know, in some cases 50% or more of the, you know, things that are going on. So it sounds like your grandpa was a pretty nonverbal guy, but you knew what was going on.
Yeah.
So I suppose if he didn't like something, do you?
I was going to say, he did let you know. That was one time he would talk, is when you're doing it wrong, he'd let you know.
Yeah. What the heck do you think you're doing there, buddy? So, well, so buddy, let's segue into meat and potatoes here. Tell me a little bit. Now you, I think in the past had told me that you grew up in Illinois?
Or correct, that, yeah, that's Central Illinois.
You went to school down there too, did you not?
Well, I ended up going to high school in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Okay. Got my undergraduate degree at Purdue University in Indiana. Okay. And then ended up going back to the University of Illinois, Champaign, where I grew up, for graduate school. So okay. I kind of did a little zigzag.
So were you always in environmental kinds of sciences?
No, I was pretty much a suburban kid. I went to high school purely to play football. I mean, to me, that was the only reason high school existed, was so that young boys could play football.
I see, yes. So young girls could come and just go, ooh, he's so cute.
You yeah, know, that wasn't a bad bonus, but mainly I just like running into people you know, and have an excuse to do it.
Did you have a lot of frustrations or whatnot?
I think I must have. Yeah, Raul. Just
beat on people.
Yeah,
come on,
yeah.
Go ahead. Try to block me. See what happens to you. There you go.
Okay. I really kind of got interested in the environment and conservation when I was in college. I then kind of worked for a year in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
And it was really kind of being out of my native environment that I think kind of really opened my eyes, because I would come back then and the Midwest felt so familiar. And then I'd go back to Georgia and the landscape, it just felt so different. And so that was really what triggered me to pursue graduate school and then kind of find my path towards conservation.
Okay. Was there an aha moment there kind of thing where you...
It is. I suppose this audience may kind of appreciate that. Again, I do kind of remember this. We were driving in the car. I was back for Christmas or the holidays, and we were driving down a country road, and the ground had been plowed up. And so it was just one of those typical Midwest gray days, right? Like
sure.
Everything was a gradation of kind of gray, of white, gray, black. And the soil was so black. And I just remember thinking, my gosh, why is that dirt so black? And I mean, I kind of had a sense of, you know, the from the glacier and the prairie. But I kind of started pursuing that. And then when I went back to Atlanta and realized just how different the ecological landscape was there, that was really what set me off. I was like, you know what? I've always lived in the Midwest. I'm from the Midwest. I kind of consider that home. I'd like to understand how it came to be. And so that was really then the pursuit of my graduate studies, and I guess, you know, still my work today.
Okay. So graduate school degree then was in conservation, or?
It was in land resources ecology was the name of the program.
Okay. Land resources. Where did you do your graduate work?
University of Illinois.
Okay. So down Champaign-Urbana?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So then that was a master's program, PhD
correct.
Program?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you get done with that program and you got to find a job to pay off those student loans, right? How
right. And, you know, so I was looking and then kind of during grad school and shortly thereafter, I got a lot of jobs. I was a pretty good field botanist at the time. I could identify lots of plants.
Okay.
And so I could get jobs kind of working for environmental consulting companies or the Nature Conservancy. But basically all my jobs were to go to a place, identify all the plants there, and then go to the next place and identify all the plants. Well, I wanted to kind of take care of a place, you know, get to know it, not just inventory it and move on. So I was looking for opportunities. I actually applied to the International Crane Foundation that had a very well-developed field ecology program, and I was thoroughly rejected. So they said no. But fortunately, I guess my stuff was impressive enough that they took it down to Nina Leopold Bradley, who her and her family were just starting the Leopold Foundation. They were looking for some seasonal help. And they said, this guy, you know, he wasn't good enough for us, but maybe you might want to take a look
at
him.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Yeah,
I appreciate your vote of confidence there, guys.
So they said yes. And they brought me on for the season. And then they, at the end of the season, they said, well, you know, you were pretty good. How would you like to stick around? And so I did. And then it was right as the Leopold Foundation was getting started. And so, you know, the family was figuring out their role. There was a board, there was staff now. And so they kind of went through a couple of executive directors. And after a couple of years, I was still the only person still there. And so I kind of got the job by
default.
They
couldn't get rid of you.
Yeah. About 25 years later, that is pretty much the case. They haven't figured out how to get rid of me. So I was supposed to be here for like 6 months, and now it's been not quite 25 years.
Boy, looking back at that, does it seem like there was a hand in it all along the way that it just made sense? I mean, people often talk about after that span of time, it's like, yeah, you know, there have been ups and downs and whatnot, but it just kind of always felt.
It's, you know, I think, again, you know, maybe this is why that Arnold Palmer quote of, you know, it's always kind of just about luck, but you got to be prepared to take advantage of it. And that's just kind of what happened. You know, I think I arrived at the right time, right place at the right time.
Sure.
And the foundation was willing and able to invest in me. So I grew as the organization grew, you know, and not everybody gets that opportunity.
Sure.
Either an organization's more developed or advanced and they need certain skills and experience, but we were able to kind of grow together. So, yeah, I think it was just kind of fortuitous that I was young and eager and willing to learn, and they were young and desperate and willing to let me learn with them.
You know, I got to say, folks, if you're listening to this whole thing and just wondering about, you know, what is Buddy Hoppiger, some sort of derelict that just happened in one day off the streets. But what little I know of Nina Leopold and the Leopold family in general, they're pretty discriminating folks. And so I don't think they'd be hiring some, you know, moron from, you know, Poughkeepsie, Illinois that said, well, hey, I like the outdoors here once you.
Well, I do. So, for a while, I used to argue that I should have multiple PhDs because all of the Leopold children had PhDs. And so every board meeting was a little bit like a PhD dissertation defense.
Sure.
They would grill you.
So you better know your facts.
You had to be on top of stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's nothing like iron sharpening iron, right? So, but anyways, folks, my guest today on Frame of Reference is Buddy Hoppiger, the executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation and Center in Baraboo, Wisconsin. We're going to take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors and come back to talk more about the challenges that Buddy has faced, as well as more about the entire concept of land ethics and what that all looks like and how we can all participate in that, I hope. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back here on 99.7 Max FM's Digital Network. PowerPoint, power naps, power lunches, we've got the power. Well, at McFarland's, we've got the power to keep you rolling, blowing, and sawing. Our automotive and power equipment service centers are all here to help keep the vroom in your life. From our biggest farm equipment to your home tractor, we'll take good care of you. From sales to service, no matter what the size, make a powerful statement and come to McFarland's at 780 Carolina Street, one block south of Highway 12, where service is a family tradition. Vroom! And we're back here again with my guest, Buddy Hoppiger, the executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation and Center in Baraboo, Wisconsin. In our first part of the meeting, interview here, Buddy is talking about how he just happened into his role at being the executive director. But as you have heard, and if you want to go back and listen to it, if you didn't catch that part of it, it had a lot more to do with working hard, I think, ultimately, and trying to stay open to the possibilities and anything else. So, Buddy, you mentioned a favorite quote of yours, and I did a little bit of research. I don't think I ever do enough, but a little bit before we sat down today, to look at the idea of land ethics and land conservation. And Leopold was very different that way. He was really a pioneer in kind of bringing all of the, I guess, accepted almost, you know, what would you call it, common domain knowledge, but really bringing it into a domain of knowledge that he was able to then successfully communicate to others, right? In a different
That's sort of really kind of his lasting legacy, I think, why we still talk about him. I mean, he was a great nature writer, but it was this concept of land ethics that people have this ethical responsibility to the natural world, that is why his writing and ideas endure, and especially for Western thought, right? I mean, there are other cultures that certainly celebrate and recognize the humanity's connection to the natural world. But kind of Western civilization has been really kind of slow to acknowledge that, accept that, implement that. And so Leopold was really one of the first and most eloquent and forceful voices for that perspective.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. I keep thinking about how working here at McFarland's has been a real eye-opener for me, because, you know, I was a city slicker, grew up in Milwaukee. I had an uncle up in northern Michigan that we would go visit, and I got some experience with farming and botany from him because he owned greenhouses and had a degree in botany as well. So, but it was not really the kind of thing that it is here, where, you know, you have an agricultural clientele for a large part of them. They depend on the land. It's their livelihood. And, you know, there seem to be two camps. There are the people that really are doing what's economically the best thing to do for them. And then there are people that do that, but they're also doing what they know to be the best thing for the land, and, you know, being caretakers of a legacy, if you will. What's the difference? I mean, how, if somebody's on that first and they're just kind of, whatever, you know, right or wrong, you know, yes, you're right, that's my wrong. Who gets to say? Is there a way that you think we can bridge that gap and get people to go, well, no, there really is a right or wrong here?
Well, we're certainly trying. I mean, I think it's harder in modern day society. People are just that much more disconnected from the natural world. You know, farmers in the agricultural community, like you say, they still are very connected. Their livelihood depends on it. So they can recognize, you know, when the soil's healthy and how to do amendments and crop rotations and those kind of things. A lot of people, though, you know, they don't notice the migrating birds coming through, or they might not even notice that they're drinking polluted water until the health effects are acute. And yet, at the end of the day, right, it's all about clean water, clean air, healthy food, and then, you know, kind of wildlife habitat that makes our communities richer, and that play a vital role in providing and protecting that clean air and clean water.
Sure.
So I think that's what a lot of our work is about, is helping people, stop and pause and observe the natural world. Like, that's the first to even know it's there.
Right.
Hello. And then two, to help them think about, okay, well, what's within their power to take care of it and to be a better steward. And, you know, that could be window boxes in the city to how you plant and manage your agricultural fields or manage your woodlands. And so we have kind of programs, you know, that are designed to help in a lot of those different aspects.
So was there something, you know, going back to Leopold and his sort of transformation of how we look at this stuff, was there a moment in his life too, where he started to recognize there's a need here? Somebody needs to codify this and really propagate it, if you will.
Well, you know, it's interesting. His family's business was, they were furniture makers.
Okay.
And so they depended on supplies of hardwoods from the upper Midwest. And this would have been in the late 1800s when what they call the massive cutover happened. And we basically deforested massive percentage of the upper Midwest. And we'd already done that to the eastern states.
Okay.
And so now we did that to the upper Midwest. And so he kind of was able to see and witness how that impacted his own family's business. So he came out of it from this familial experience and economic reality. And so it was always grounded in that. But then as he was able to engage the outdoors, he also saw these other kind of wonderful personal, emotional, spiritual values. And so I think that's what he was always trying to hold together, is there's always the economic reality. I mean, humans are species that have to fight for survival, like my favorite river otters, right?
Right, right.
But how do we do that in a healthy, more sustainable way, in a more ethical way that respects all the health and wealth we get from the natural world? And then how do we redistribute that within our human communities? So I think that's, you know, that's my assessment of how he approached it. I don't think it was a pivotal moment. I cannot say that word.
Pivotal moment.
Yes. I've struggled, I don't want to give up on it.
And I'm not editing that out either. People are going to hear your struggle, okay? Just so you know up front.
So I don't think there was one single moment, but I think it was that body of experience that he came to witness and then wanted to make a difference, you know, in his own life and work.
Is there if you had to, you know, I would think you have this happen where there are people that come into the center that obviously don't get it. You know, they came maybe because their mom made them, or they came because, you know, it's a field trip and they were forced to. Are there things that you think can happen there or that can be done there to sort of illuminate or at least get people to, hey, you know, smell that or take a look here, see what's going on with this?
I mean, we kind of use Leopold's writing. He talks about this one little flower called Draba. He says it was once given a name and then forgotten. It plucks no heartstrings. And yet, basically, it's his example of a little teeny flower that if you actually stop and look at, it's like amazingly beautiful and like kind of makes you stop and wonder about the awe of the world that, you know, all these things are around us. So
sure.
We have a framework that we often use called observe, participate, reflect. And so the first step is just to get people stopped, to take a look around, and then have them reflect on what are they seeing? Why have they stopped to see it? Or what do they notice about it? And then that participation element usually comes into, okay, so maybe now you're motivated to recycle or to plant a tree or to have a garden at home. So that's kind of our sequence. We ask people to stop and observe. We ask them to think and reflect a little bit and then actively engage in kind of change making.
Boy, there's an awful lot of like business theories and all kinds of methodologies that utilize a similar kind of approach too, right? So
a lot of it is social science, right? Like how do we motivate people? Again, you know, the science of getting of anti-smoking or recycling, you know, yeah, sure. You have to understand how people view and experience the world and then how you kind of move them to behavior change.
Do you find that there's a most difficult portion in that process or a part that, you know, you really have to work perhaps a little harder at or constantly change up or, you know?
Yeah, well, we're a little fortunate, you know, a lot of people who somehow come into our orbit are a little predisposed to being interested. Sure. So there are other organizations working on that real kind of frontline observing of just getting people to like stop and pause. So they're doing some of the hard work for us. We kind of pick it up a little bit after that step, though we do have some audiences that do that. I think the other thing is just the continuous reaffirmation. So, you know, the other thing is people kind of, they get it. They want to do something. And then life gets busy. The world intervenes, right? And their attention gets distracted. So, yeah, coming back to them, having that opportunity to remind them, oh, remember you cared about this or this was, right. You know, right. You really like this little flower. Maybe you should plant some in your yard. Right. So a lot of our work in that regard is with woodland landowners across the state of Wisconsin. And so it is a lot about trying to stay in front of them and keep, you know, if they own land, they care about it at some level, at least to pay the taxes.
Sure.
So it's how do we stay in front of them enough that, you know, this season, oh, you might want to be thinking about these things.
Sure.
And then the next season, there's a new list and kind of finding ways also to kind of thank and give them that positive encouragement for what they did do.
Sure.
But it's none of this is one hit wonders. You know,
right.
It is very rare that you present something to somebody and then they're just off and running and never need to hear from you again.
Right. Yeah. It's that constant sort of building and nurturing. Sounds an awful like it's an organic process, honestly. You know, got to tend that garden if you want to see anything grow.
That's right.
Pull out the weeds, all that good stuff. So have there been things that you've seen in 25 years thereabouts of working in this domain, have there been significant changes or tectonic shifts, if you will, in conservationism and land ethics that you've seen different challenges arise or, you know, different opportunities arise that weren't there before, different strengths, different weaknesses. I mean, I think we have a tendency to think of it as a political process almost because, you know, if you're a Democrat, you care. If you're a Republican, you don't. I mean, it's almost that, you know, black
and
white,
you know,
it seems.
Interestingly,
sometimes.
It is important to remind people that a lot of the good environmental conservation legislation came out of Republican administrations. This used to be, you know, conservation is to be a conservative action, right? I mean, it is about being thoughtful, thinking long-term, being prudent. So it's a bit unfortunate that it has become kind of seen as a divisive issue. I think still, in many ways, it doesn't have to be. But that's a bit of a challenge, is just perception and then these different camps that sit out there and trying to coalesce the energy and interest that does exist. You know, another real challenge, and you know, this is, I mean, it's created all sorts of other opportunities, but technology is, again, just continued to siphon off interest and activity of people who used to spend time outdoors. Now, COVID, interestingly, there was nearly a 40% increase in outdoor activity in the state of Wisconsin over the last year.
Right.
So, you know, people wanted and needed to get away from their technology because that's all they had, and they were looking to the outdoors. So a question will be is, can we maintain that? Have we captured new audience? Can, again, we keep that of interest to them, keep them coming back to state parks and county parks and spending time outside, will be an interest. So there's kind of a moment in time here. And then the other, I think, that is new is in kind of making conservation more about people. So, you know, for a long time, it's been about, well, it's about the birds, it's about the bees, it's about protecting these places and keeping people out. I think one of the new shifts is recognizing that, you know what, good, bad, or indifferent, people are the reality.
Right.
And so we have to figure out how we do connect people in healthy ways, how we connect people to each other, and make sure there are strong human community networks as well as their connection to the natural world. So I think in the last year, that has really emerged. Some of it is with, you know, the exposure of a lot of the racial injustices that have been present in our country for a long time, and kind of the need to converge conservation, environmental interests and thought with social justice.
Well, and it does seem to me, you know, when you talk about the urbanization and kids that come from, you know, very urban environments, some of the most successful programs have been the ones where they've been able to take kids from those kinds of environments and expose them to an outdoor world that they've never seen before. And once you can get past the, ooh, look at that bug, you know, kind of stuff, you know, or the, what's that smell? Oh my God, it's like crap. And it's like, well, that is crap. So, you know, the farmers have been fertilizing the field. Oh my God, you know, you have to get past all of that, I suppose. But, you know, you can structure that so you don't do it during manure week, right? So, but
yeah, I mean, no, that cultural exchange is really important. I mean, you know, one of the funnest partnerships we have is with the Nature Center on the south side of Chicago. And they're bringing agriculture into their community. They got chickens, they got gardens. And, you know, here is a population that otherwise doesn't, you know, it's just not easy for them to get to a state park in Wisconsin. But they got a prairie, they got a wetland, they got rabbits, they got chickens. I mean, all in 10 acres in a city park. Yeah. And so, you know, it's been fun. And they look to Aldo Leopold and the land ethic as part of their foundational platform.
Sure.
And so those kind of conversations of, wow, our world's so different. And yet, look at all the things that are still the same.
So do you have any like special anecdotes or memories over the past 25 years of things where you've seen some kid or even an adult, I mean, just somebody that just kind of had this moment of revelation, or, you know, where you were a part of them kind of getting to a new point of, this was just what I needed right now, or I never saw it that way before. Those,
I think that phrase, I never saw that, you know, before is one we just hear a lot. And it's so rewarding for all parties.
Right.
And again, you know, one of the primary audiences we work with are landowners. And one of the things we'll do is we'll do a walk in their woods or a walk through their prairie. And, you know, when we can start to say, oh, these, look at these special plants, and oh, look at these problematic plants, and oh, look at why your trees are growing this way, and have you noticed kind of what's happening on your stream bank? Like, all of a sudden, they're picking up the cues and coming up with their own set of tools to see their own landscape differently or anew. And then to go back, you know, a couple of years later, and then they're pointing out to you, look at this and look at that. And here's what we did over here. And we're really fortunate because we work with enough landowners that we just, you know, we have that experience over and over again. And so to see them at every stage in that progression is both really rewarding to us. So it's like, okay, we're helping people make a difference and see things differently.
Tangible success.
And then they get that positive feedback because they start to realize I'm having success and this is being affirmed by the Leopold Foundation. Right. And now I get to bring my friends and relatives out here and I get to show them and so they become the educators. So that's just a really fun experience.
Sounds like organics again here. We're planting seeds, the seeds grow, another plants, they have grow seeds.
That's right. You gotta, yes. From tiny acorns come great oaks.
Or mustard seeds even, you know, the big bushes that come out of those. Folks, I hate to do this, but we're going to have to do another two-parter, I think, because Buddy and I think are just getting going personally. At least I feel that way. We're going to just take another break here to hear a word from our sponsors and wrap up part one of our two-part episodes with Buddy Hoffaker, the executive director of the Alta Leopold Center. Don't go anywhere. I'll be back with closing comments on this. And make sure you tune in next week at Frame of Reference to hear how this all comes out, okay? Take care.
Big deals. There's never been a better time to support small businesses and save big with MaxFM Big Deals. Discount certificates from the MaxFM Big Deals store will save you up to 50% off retail every day of the week. Local restaurants and wineries, healthy living and spa services, gifts for the holidays, and a whole lot more. New deals are added weekly. Check it out now at MaxFMBigDeals.com. That's MaxFMBigDeals.com. Start shopping and start saving.
Okay, here we go again. It's time for some definitional background, because I'm a big proponent of making sure that we all understand the real meaning, not the I think it means meaning of the big words we throw around and assume we all understand them to mean the same thing. How's that for hyperbole? Merriam-Webster defines ethics as the moral principles that govern a person's behavior or the conducting of an activity. Buddy and the staff at the Alta Leopold Center carry that further into the idea of a land ethic, which directs all members of a community to treat one another with respect for the mutual benefit of all. And they expand the definition of community to include not only humans, but all other parts of the earth as well. Soils, waters, plants, and animals, or what Leopold called the land. Man, is there ever a need for that today or what? Forget about all the rhetoric that's used to polarize us these days and just think about how we conduct our activities and how we should treat one another with respect for the mutual benefit of all. Where are the voices for that today and what keeps us from listening? Ask yourself, what's my frame of reference for determining who and how that's determined for me? What would happen if we decided that my conduct, my community, all start with me? Think about that until next week, when I'll be back with my bud, Buddy. Oh, and if you haven't yet, check out our new website at www.forsauk.com and drop us a line. We'd love to hear about your frame of reference. Stay well.